The rusty patch bumblebee used to be common all over the Midwest. It's now become the first bee species in the continental U.S. to land on the endangered species list. Bee expert Gene Robinson joins us to explain what's going on. Plus, we'll talk recent food and health news headlines with WBEZ reporter Monica Ng. And how would you like to get locked in a room and use science to figure your way out? We learn about the new nonprofit escape room that's recently opened up in Urbana. But first,
I think I'm living proof that somebody can change. I didn't start out as a racist. I became a racist for 7 years. So I wasn't born that way. So I did change from being a non-racist to a racist back to a non-racist.
That's former white supremacist Christian Picciolini. He's the co-founder of the Chicago-based Life After Hate. We talked to him about how his federal funding may now be in jeopardy. That's all coming up on this Encore edition of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As you know, we are in the middle for WILL of a very special pledge drive. It's a marathon drive. And for the first part of today's program, I've got a very special guest in studio with me, Jeremy Hobson. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi. It's great to be back in the studio, the first studio probably that I ever was in at WILL in this new building.
And it's so great to have you here. By the way, Jeremy is here. We're going to talk about his work, my work, the work that we do. You all can join us because we would love to have your support this hour. It's a marathon drive. We're going to explain what that means in a little bit. But we've got an overall goal in this crazy 26.2 hours of fundraising to raise $100,000. Really, the amount that any amount that you can give contributes to that. And you can do that by calling 217-244-9455. That's 217-244-9455. You can go online to willpledge.org. Jeremy Hobson, Urbana native, right? Not
yes,
Champaign
Urbana.
Native.
Yep.
I felt like I can never get that one wrong. Uni High grad, you're right across the street almost from Uni High. Now, of course, all of you who do not know hear his voice on Here and Now. Some of you may not know his local roots here. So let's talk a little bit about Here and Now, the show. You guys, it's great. Is this year three now of Here
this
and Now?
This is year four, year four of the new Here and Now. We'll hit the 4 year mark on July 1st of this year. That's when I started there. Here
right.
and Now existed as
I know
a
I'm counting it from when
a
you
long
started.
Time ago. Right, exactly.
Well,
but
I'm
yes.
calling also to be fair, not just from you started, when it became a national show and an NPR production.
Yeah,
as
and
well.
When it did, we started with an audience of about 3 million people around the country per week. We just got our latest numbers recently, and now we're at 5 million. So
wow,
we have really grown in the last couple. Thank you. I mean, one of the things about that is just that the news, I think, is so important right now. People want to know what's going on, and our show tries to deliver that every single day in, you know, segments from around the country and around the world. And I think that's what's driven up the numbers. I mean, hopefully it's also because we're doing a good job.
I think it's because we're doing a good job. But, you know, it's the same thing we're seeing. We're seeing that with the 21st. We're seeing that NPR is seeing that nationally. We're seeing that as well. We hope that this is that folks value what we do. We're seeing that from the numbers. Today we're asking people to put a dollar number on amount on it, which you can do by going to willpledge.org. But when you are talking about Here and Now and the work that goes into it, I think people don't realize it's the same thing with the 21st. They hear us, right? They hear you or they hear me, and they think, wow, you guys do a great job every day. How many producers does Here and Now have?
We have probably 16 to 20. It depends on the day.
Right.
You know, sometimes there are more, sometimes there are fewer, but it's a lot of people. I mean, every single segment, you've got to have somebody who is able to read up on it, research it, know, you know, enough about it to put it together. And then they work with me or with Robin or with you, I mean, the host of the show, and, you know, make sure that you're up to speed on what you need to know. Because, you know, public radio listeners are very tough, I must say.
Yeah.
They want you to ask certain questions, and they get angry
at you.
They want
you to ask intelligent questions.
They want you to ask intelligent
questions.
And they want you to follow up. And they want you to, when somebody says something that is not true, they want you to push back on that person. And so that takes a lot of work. You got to know a lot about a lot of different things. I mean, I'm trying to think of the, you know, that there are certain topics that I'm scared of because I know that
really?
They are so... Let me put it this way.
Do you feel like when there are politicians that come on.
Yeah.
And we, you know, you like here and now is like the 21st in that we cover a wide variety of topics. But I feel like there are certain guests, and I am going to put the blame on politicians for being the most likely of these guests, who are there with a very clear agenda, which is not necessarily answering your question.
Right. And also there are topics that people know so much about follow so closely. Like, I'll just put out there, the Middle East peace process. Anything involving Israel and the Palestinians, you got to know your stuff, because if you don't ask a certain question, you know,
or you
people
ask it the
are
wrong way.
Angry. Exactly.
And so you have producers that are helping prepare you, that are giving you background material. That's the same thing with the 21st. We have producers that work on the show, but you have a 2-hour national show. On average, how many conversations are you having in those 2 hours?
We probably have about 8 per hour.
Okay.
So I would say half of those go to me and half of those go to Robin.
Right.
And
so you're preparing for, but overall you're
6 to 8 interviews per day, I would say.
Day.
Yeah.
On completely different topics.
On different topics. Most of the time, unless it's some overwhelming story that, you know, we have to do multiple times in different ways.
And you should, I would love for you to explain to everyone too, with Here and Now, because you all sort of do this rollout, you're also updating the show, especially if there's breaking news. You're changing different parts of the show as you guys are rolling it out.
Right. So you guys air us here on WILL at 1 o'clock, right? Which is actually 2 o'clock Eastern time. So it's the second run of our show. We're on the air live from 12 to 2, and then we're on the air across the country from 2 to 4. But we're updating those. If anything changes in any of those stories, we've got to update them. If some new story breaks, we will, you know, blow out parts of the show and just do it again.
Right. So, and for our listeners, I know what Jeremy's doing, and I know what the team in Here Now is doing, because they email us and we get these email updates of a rundown which say, OK, we're throwing out the top of this and replacing it with this because this happened. We need to update this. And so you guys are doing that in a constant process during what time frame?
Oh, I mean, 12 to 4, basically, Eastern
every day.
Time. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Every day you guys are doing that. So Jeremy Hobson is here with me on the 21st. It was so cool to have you here. When we were walking in, you were pointing out the 21st office was actually where, was that where you did?
It was there was an ag office there, and I did my very first WILL ag report, which, you know, it's very difficult to do. The December hogs and all that stuff, that's like you're reading off a screen that has all these weird numbers on it that you
and
have
you
to sort
of
translate.
You can't get that wrong either, obviously.
Exactly. And yeah, so I have a lot of history in this building.
Yeah. It's great to have you here. He is here as part of our special WILL marathon. This is an idea. If you would like to, willpledge.org is our website. 217-244-9455 is the number. Can you explain? We actually, WILL took this idea of a marathon fund drive from WBUR.
Right.
Can you explain sort of that thinking behind like this marathon drive of kind of compressing everything into everything, instead of a week of fundraising, compressing that into a very limited time period?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've done now, I think I've just hit my 1 millionth public radio pledge drive in the course of my life. And in every single one.
And if you
one,
call now, you could be Jeremy's right, 1 millionth and one.
Exactly.
Member.
But, you know, every time going all the way back, people want it to be shorter. They are annoyed. And I don't blame them. They don't want to hear us talking about how important it is to contribute to public radio. They want to just hear the public radio that they love and all the shows that they want to hear. And they want to hear the news. So WBUR was basically, you know, they came to the conclusion that the best way to do that would be to keep the fundraiser as short as possible. Keeping in mind, there are stations out there that have 3-week fundraisers. Now that would drive me crazy.
3 weeks
long.
Oh wow, I've
fundraising.
Never been at a station that's done that. Okay.
So we said, okay, well, why don't we just try to raise all the money that we would raise in a week? WBUR tends to do 1-week fundraisers. Why don't we try to do all the money we raise in a week in just 26.2 hours, tying it in with the marathon? And last year we did it and we made all the money. Just barely, by the way, with a real squeaker at the finish, but we did make it at the end and then just did it again last week with a bigger goal than last year and managed to make it all in 26.2 hours, which is incredible. But I think also the listeners appreciate that. They go, you're listening to me. I told you I didn't want to hear a lot of fundraising. I want to hear the news. There's so many important things going on right now. You're listening to me and helping me, and I'm going to help you do that.
So I am going to call out all of the people who are listening right now who are not members, because that's why we do these drives. We do these drives to remind our members of their importance and to thank them for people who already support us. But there are a lot of people listening who do not support the station. And I always ask, Jeremy, you've got a cup of coffee there. How much did you pay for that cup of coffee this morning?
Oh, probably $1.50.
$1.50, because I see you've got Burger King on there. I'm probably
it's right across the street
right
from WIL.
Our brand new Burger King that we all go to way too much now. Right. So do you buy coffee every day?
No, I don't buy coffee every single day. But because we have coffee at WBUR.
Yeah, that's
free.
Probably but, really good right, coffee, right? Right? Public radio stations normally have good coffee. All right. So that was my analogy for those of you who buy coffee every day to think about things that you pay for on a daily basis that you use on a daily basis. And how much of you listen to Here and Now? How many of you listen to the 21st on a daily basis or a regular basis? And if you're not supporting the work we do, that's why we have these marathon drives. So especially for those of you who are able to contribute, and I'm thinking about our Vision Circle, our Leadership Circle members. The great thing about being in a university community is, Jeremy, you know this, you grew up here. Like there's sort of a huge listening level of people who are everywhere from students to professors to retired faculty and staff members. So I would say to those of you who are in a financial position to subsidize people who maybe are on income where they're graduate students or others who listen but maybe can't afford to give as much as perhaps you could, our Vision Circle recognizes people who contribute 1,000 or more each year. Our Leadership Circle acknowledges gifts of $250 to $999 annually. Leadership Circle, that's basically a dollar a day. So if you could support a dollar a day at our station, you can join our Leadership Circle. You can do that by calling 217-244-9455. That's 217-244-9455. You can go online to willpledge.org. You know, Jeremy, I don't know if you saw Current did this campaign recently, and it's part of, I think, a lot of what we were talking about at the beginning is sort of the importance of the media, the importance of news media. I think we've seen so much conversation about fake news and I think information overload. We were already at a point where people were feeling overloaded and overwhelmed with the information we had. I guess I just wanted to ask you, why do you think it's important for people to support public media?
Well, I'm glad you brought up fake news, because I think that one thing that you can say about what you hear on the radio, on WILL, on NPR, is it's real news. You're getting real, fair news that people are spending all day long to make sure that what they're telling you is accurate. Are there mistakes occasionally? Absolutely. But I can guarantee you that people are trying to bring you the truth every single day. And we've heard about how important, and especially now, how important a free press is to our democracy. This is the opportunity that you have as a listener to this station to actually stand up and be part of that press. You appreciate the news that you listen to every single day on WILL. You appreciate being able to hear perspectives from around the country and around the world, different perspectives every day.
How can you support that? How do you try to do that on Here and Now? How do you try to get as diverse perspectives as possible on the air?
I mean, we you know, I like to go through the show because, you know, when you're doing a daily show and you've got to get people into studios and this and that, sometimes you get used to bringing a lot of the same people on to the radio.
Right, you call the people who you know are going to get there in half an hour.
Exactly.
Right.
So I like to go through the show. And as I said, we have about 16 segments a day. I like to go through the show at the end of the day and go, A, did we have at least two people on the show that have never been on the show before? And usually the answer to that is yes.
That's pretty good. Wow.
And then, you know, I also like to look at, you know, not just racial diversity, but also geographic diversity. Make sure that we're not just putting people on who are in New York and Washington, you know, and California, but trying to get all around the country. I mean, as somebody who grew up here, I hate the term flyover because that's ridiculous. I mean, it's not a flyover place. It's a place where people live, and it's just as important as any other place in the country. But we try to get, you know, as you know, on Here and Now, I've sort of made a regular out of Lisa Miceli at Uni High, my college counselor, who's amazing. And by the way, I think she just won a big award for the, you know, College Counselors
Association.
And
she was on the 21st last week. So,
yeah.
Because we were talking actually about students leaving Illinois and how many high school students are not coming here anymore or are choosing to go to college elsewhere for financial aid reasons and stuff like that. Yeah. So listen, we've just got about a minute or two left. And I just wonder, as you're thinking about that, you're in a really unique position, as you said, as someone who grew up outside the coasts. And I, like you, have sort of, I grew up on the coast, except I grew up in Miami. So like the southern part of the East Coast, I have this sort of visceral coastal cultural attitudes dictating the news. And I know you have that as well. And I guess I just wonder now, as you think about how you guys are kind of preparing to cover everything in the next year or two, how are you thinking even more about that when we're thinking about like the rural urban divide? We're thinking about all the conversations we had with the election about, did we cover everything properly? How are you guys handling that?
Last year, leading up to the election, did probably 20 remote broadcasts. We went all over the country. One of the things that's happened with Here and Now is that it used to be a money losing show, and now it's a money making show, in part because the audience is bigger and, you know, underwriting costs more and all that kind of stuff. But we said, let's take some money from our surplus and get out all over the country. And we did remote broadcasts in, you know, the West, in the South, in the Midwest, in Florida, in the Southeast, all over the country, trying to hear from voters all last year and trying to tell stories that were political in nature and stories that were not political in nature. We're doing more of that this year. I will say one thing, the greatest remote broadcast that I have done at Here and Now is on the 100th anniversary of the national parks. We did the show from Yellowstone National Park, from Old Faithful, which was so cool.
That's Here and Now's Jeremy Hobson, an Urbana native, with me, Nyla Boodoo, on the 21st. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned, guys. We've got more of the show coming up ahead. And Jeremy, of course, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
This is an encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Spring is a time that many of us look forward to for the new growth and new flowers. And of course, along with flowers come bees. There's one species of bumblebee that we may not see around as much anymore. It's the rusty patched bumblebee. It used to be a common sight throughout the Midwest. Its numbers have declined so much that it just became the first bee species in the continental U.S. to land on the endangered species list. That protected status is given by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. To help us understand more, we're joined now in studio by one of the world's leading experts on bees. He's the director of the Institute for Genomic Biology at the University of Illinois, where he also teaches entomology. Gene Robinson is in studio with me. Hi, Gene. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
So what's happening with the rusty-patched bumblebee?
Well, what's happening with this bumblebee is what we see happening for other species as well, and honeybees as well. And that is, we're seeing a decline in the populations. Species that previously had been quite prevalent, or individuals were easily spotted, they're becoming more rare and more rare. This particular species hasn't been seen in quite some time now, precipitating this this action, which is, you know, a mixed bag. On one hand, it's a sad realization of where we've gotten to with these very, very important creatures. On the other hand, maybe this attention will be what's needed to help turn things around.
So, Gene, when you say you haven't seen it, does it mean the populations have declined so much that they're literally not something that really, I'm wondering, at what level do you get to endangered in terms of numbers when you're thinking about a bee species?
Yeah, I mean, you look at really precipitous declines and then a very, very small number of sightings. I think this particular species hasn't been seen in quite some time now.
And since we're talking about sightings, I wonder if you can describe a little bit of what they look like. Earlier, we were looking at pictures. I tweeted out a picture of one, by the way. They're kind of fuzzy. They're very cute. Can you describe what the rusty patch bumblebee particular looks like? It's different than a honeybee.
Yes. Yeah. So it's bigger than a honeybee. It has the same body design, three basic body parts, head, thorax, and abdomen. and two pairs of wings, six legs. So it's the basic insect design and the basic bee design. A key feature of bees is, as you said, they're fuzzy. They're very hairy. Their hairs actually are, the technical word is plumose. And a simpler way to think about them is they're sort of like split ends. So they just divide finer and finer. And this allows the pollen to adhere to their bodies. So they are, many of their features are adapted to have this coevolution with plants and insects, to, I should say, reflect this coevolution of plants and insects, and in this case, for bumblebees, to be able to carry pollen efficiently from one flower to the other.
You were just sort of describing the structure of bees, their physical makeup, and why they're really important. And I think many people hear the term pollinators. We know bees play an important role in pollinating flowers and food production. We looked it up earlier. We saw some estimates anywhere from a third to nearly three quarters of the world's food crop rely to some extent on bees. Why is that?
So plants have two different ways of reproducing. One way is they produce pollen and it's spread by the wind, and then it goes to other plants and then instigates the whole reproductive process that results, of course, in seeds and then vegetation and so forth. The other process requires animals to actually move the pollen from one plant to another. The pollen is stickier. It just doesn't blow in the wind the way the other species' pollen do. And so they require, these plants will require animals to physically move the pollen from one plant to another. Insects are the premier pollinators on the planet for this group. And of the animal pollinators, it's the bees that are the premier animals pollinating. So they are really very important for many different crops in our agricultural systems. These are crops that are very important from a nutritional point of view, fruit crops, vegetables, seed crops, a lot of the food that adds important nutrition and breadth and diversity to our diet.
And Gene, I imagine that a lot of crops grown here in Illinois for the agricultural industry, what crops in particular would be dependent on pollinators?
So squashes, apples, things of that nature, sunflowers.
Okay.
Alfalfa.
And alfalfa.
I could keep going, but I'll stop.
Okay. And why and what is it particularly, the rusty patch bumblebee, is that something that was at one point in time native to Illinois and to the Midwest?
Yes. So bumblebees are native to the Western Hemisphere, native to North America. By contrast, honeybees are not. Honeybees were introduced to North America. Bumblebees are native, so they have co-evolved with a lot of our plants in this area. They also, as a result, are associated with their being native to climates like this. They can forage in cooler weather than honeybees. Honeybees originated in the tropics. They have expanded their range. They do a magnificent job in a variety of climates pollinating. But bumblebees, this is kind of their home turf. They're adapted to this area, and they are able to forage under cooler temperatures, which is very important because many of the crops are flowering early in the spring when it is cooler.
I think people, Gene, might actually be surprised to learn, because I think we've seen so much media reports about the decline of the bee population across the U.S. People might be surprised this is actually the first time that bees are on the endangered species list. What do we know about, I know there's lots of theories and questions about why the bee population generally, when we're not just talking about bumblebees, but honeybees, the entire species is on the decline. Can you tell us a little bit about where that's happening? Is that happening across the world? Do we know why?
So the declines have been noted now for about 10 years. This is actually the 11th year since the major calamity first started being noticed. And after this amount of time, we now have a pretty good handle on the scope of the problem in terms of identifying the main factors. The problem is that it's quite complicated. There is no single smoking gun. There are many people that are passionate about blaming the situation on one particular factor. But in fact, a consensus is starting to emerge in the scientific community that it's multifactorial. There are four factors primarily at play. One is pathogens. The second is parasites. The third is pesticides. And the fourth is poor nutrition. And so there's evidence that all four of these are involved in weakening bees, stressing bees, and the very interesting and problematic discovery is that these factors interact in as yet very unpredictable ways.
I'm speaking with Gene Robinson. We're talking in particular about the rusty patch bumblebee. We've been talking about bees a lot, but in particular, that's the Midwestern bee that has now been placed on the endangered species list. We've actually got a caller. Gene, can I ask you, can you put your headphones on so you can hear the caller who's
sure.
Just so you can hear the question that he's going to ask
mm-hmm.
as well. Hey, Joe, welcome to the 21st. What's your question?
Hi, I work with a lot of farmers who are using cover crops here in Central Illinois, and I was just curious if, I'm not sure if you know what sort of plants are being used as cover crops, but if there's anything in particular that could be planted to help the rusty patch bumblebee and other pollinators.
Yeah, anything farmers can do. Yeah, thanks for that call, Joe.
That's a great question, and there are many flowers, plants with certain kinds of flowers that are very attractive to bees. These can be planted as cover crops. They also can be planted by gardeners and landowners anywhere. The more flowers that are bee-friendly flowers, the better. So there are lists that are available that indicate which plants produce flowers that are attractive. Alfalfa, various kinds of clover, which are used as cover crops in this area, are really attractive to bees. Buckwheat, which is used to be used, I think is less so. You probably know more than I do about that, but that's a crop that's been really, really very attractive to bees, those flowers. Sunflowers are another one that's grown in this area. So there are a variety of plants that produce flowers that are very attractive to bees. And the more bee-friendly flowers, the better the situation, both in gardens as well as in our fields.
And now that the rusty-patched bumblebee is on the endangered species list, what does that mean in terms of, are there any special regulations that come into effect in terms of this? I know this is a list created by U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Are there any extra protections in place that will also try to help the population, Gene?
Well, there's a lot of encouragement to improve practices and to safeguard. So reading the labels carefully on pesticides and applying them according to regulations is something that's being encouraged now because of this, or I should say encouraged more. There are land use changes that are being encouraged. Other aspects of the pollinator protection program that was developed by the previous administration are in effect and will be further encouraged as a result of this.
What do you want the average person listening to know about this? Maybe people who are gardeners or people who kind of hear these stories about bees in decline and now about, in particular, the rusty patch bumblebee.
Well, I think we could distill it into two particular topics. One is that bees are tremendous pollinators. They do an amazing job pollinating, in part because of their social life. So bumblebees are social insects. Honeybees are social insects. And what this means is that when you see a bee out collecting food, she's not collecting it for herself. She's not stopping off for a meal and going to continue on to something else. She's collecting food for her younger sisters, and that's for the good of the colony. And so these individuals that are out collecting food are pollinator machines. They're out there moving from flower to flower, collecting as much as they can. Evolution has sculpted them into pollinating machines with superb navigating abilities, behavioral mechanisms to be able to collect as much pollen as possible and spread it in ways that are appropriate for helping plants to reproduce. So bumblebees live in societies, small societies. Honeybees live in much larger societies, but both are highly social, and that contributes to their big impact. They have an outsized impact on the environment because of their sociality. So that would be one thing. And then the second thing is, just to repeat what I said before, one thing that anyone can do is to encourage the growth of more flowers and to encourage responsible use of pesticides. Both of these are very important.
Gene Robinson is an entomologist with the University of Illinois. He's the director of the Institute for Genomic Biology. Gene, thanks for being with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Speaking of food, we know that fast food isn't the best thing for kids. But several years ago, a nationwide initiative known as the Kids Live Well program was launched by the National Restaurants Association. The goal was to promote more healthy options on kids' menus. Well, a new study from the Harvard School of Public Health shows that despite that effort, kids' menus at U.S. chain restaurants are just as unhealthy today as they were 5 years ago. To help us understand more about this and several other recent news headlines, we're joined now by WBEZ's food and health reporter, Monica Eng. She's on the line with us from WBEZ in Chicago. Monica, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
What did researchers find in this study about fast food menus and kids' menus?
Well, they found that despite this program that's supposed to improve the quality of the menus, they really haven't changed that much, and that, in fact, about 80% of the beverage options are still sweet drinks.
And so is it just that the healthy options aren't available, or is it just that kids aren't choosing them?
Well, that wasn't clear, because basically they just analyzed what's actually being offered on the menu. But they do say that, you know, some of the new healthier options are still sweetened milk and sweet tea. And if you're talking about the consumption of sugar through liquids, which can hit your system much faster and, you know, arguably contribute more to obesity, that doesn't help things much. So, you know, you can also talk to any kid and say, huh, if you were offered a glass of water or that sweet milk, what would you choose? I think probably, you know, if the kids are choosing rather than the parents, they're choosing the sweet drinks. But unfortunately, this data looked at what's being offered.
Okay. And so let me ask you just about another report. This was from CDC, the CDC report about the rising consumption of sugary drinks among kids. And this was also kind of to the sugary drink point, not great news for how much kids are drinking.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, if you're going to be offering these kids and 80% of these healthy meals sweet drinks, it looks like they want to grab them. Two-thirds of all kids are having at least one sweet drink a day, and about one-third are having two. And again, you know, the links of obesity, heart disease, all sorts of, you know, type 2 diabetes to sweet drinks does not make this seem like quite a healthy trend. I mean, there have been studies looking at that, and in general in the United States, soda consumption has gone down. Sugary beverage consumption has gone down. And actually, if you do compare these numbers from the 2009-2010 numbers, these numbers came from 2011-14, kids were drinking about 155 calories of sugar a day back then. Now it's 143. That's not a huge change.
Well, at least it's going down, right? So when you say sweet drinks, that doesn't mean just soda then. What else do you include
in
sugary?
Yeah. We're talking about Gatorade. We're talking about juices. You know, juices, which every parent was like, yay, I give my kids juice. And then they say, I give my kids 100% juice. They pretty much act the same.
Right.
In your system, when your body's processing, it's sugar is sugar, and it's liquid sugar that your body is processing very quickly and can be turned into fat.
Okay. So in that sense, I mean, guides for parents, I mean, need to be thinking, it sounds like parents need to be thinking a little bit more about juice or milk or just sort of looking at that sugar content, Monica?
Yeah. I mean, the latest recommendation is one sugary drink a week for young children.
A week?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean,
this
science has been revisited, and a lot of people are still scratching their heads. They're like, juice? You mean like pure orange juice? That's not okay. Well, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics is saying, let's reduce that a lot.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Monica Eng, talking food and health. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Stay tuned to hear more of this encore edition of the show. Coming up, we'll have more stories and news from across Illinois. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest from WBEZ in Chicago Public Media is Monica Ng. She covers food and health. We've been talking about fast food. We've been talking about sugary drinks. Monica, I'm going to just talk about one other thing that happens in fast food meals, and that's the apples. The apples that are the healthy option that's available in some fast food meals. I know the other day my five-year-old niece refused to eat it because she said it tasted weird. She said, I don't like how they taste. They taste too chemically. I wanted to ask you about this because there's now genetically modified apples that are coming to grocery stores in the Midwest this month. They're non-browning apples. So can you tell us about that?
Sure. They've got a gene that's been changed to slow an enzyme that contributes to browning. And, you know, they say this is the first GMO product going directly to consumers that has a clear benefit to consumers. They think it might be a game changer in terms of how people see GMOs. Other people say, well, we'd like to see this studied more. And other critics say, you know what, if these don't brown, how can we know visually that this might be an older product that we might not want to have?
Oh, okay, so that's an interesting question. They might not be. Is it possible that they could be bad but not brown? So I guess you would just know when you bit into it if it was like mushy?
Yeah, I mean, they'd have to go through other clues rather than the browning. And so, you know, some people say, is this something we really need? And other people say, well, if it gets kids to eat more fruit, isn't that a good thing? So there are a lot of pros and cons on this one.
Right, and that's the thing. Like right now, like with the apples, the ones that you get that are, do they spray something on them so they don't brown? Is that why they kind of taste a little chemically?
Usually ascorbic acid, which is, you know, you find it a lot in lemons. You know, some people say put lemons on your fruit so that they don't brown so quickly. And I haven't seen any studies that say ascorbic acid is bad, but I guess people are saying if it's already in the gene of the apple, you don't even have to have that second application there.
Right. So it's kind of interesting to see if kids pick it or not. Before I let you go, Monica, I just wanted to ask, there's been so much news in Washington about President Trump's nominees and policies. I just wanted to ask you about what the general expectations are, what you're hearing from different food advocates in the food community about the new administration.
Sure, lightning round on this. Meat. Meat people are unhappy. About 60% of our red meat goes to NAFTA and TPP countries, so they do not like to feel like there's a slowing in that. The meat packing industry relies highly on refugees. Ever since undocumented workers were cracked down on, refugees are the go-to. So meat packing, not happy. Those who've always felt like regulations from FDA and EPA were too onerous on food, they're happy to hear about this regulation reform.
Right. Sonny Perdue, right, is the pick for agricultural secretary, obviously someone from the industry.
Mm-hmm. Former Georgia governor. Some people, like Tom Vilsack, has given him his nod of approval. This is the only outgoing secretary who's given the nod of approval to the next proposed one. But others say that he was really slow to act when Georgia had its peanut crisis. And he is in the peanut industry. And lastly, people are really nervous about a breakdown in trade with Mexico, who buys and trades a huge amount of food back and forth between the United States. You know, guacamole lovers, this could, by some accounts, mean 10% more on each avocado.
10%.
10 cents
more per avocado, right? We've seen a lot of that. Avocado, I guess when we do rely a lot on Mexico, Monica, for a lot of different food imports.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. A huge amount. And people are saying, you know, this is really going to hurt those really important imports between the two countries.
Right. And
they're
so
to move their products back and forth because they don't know when this is going to break down.
Right. So lots of things.
Trade associations and companies wrote a letter, including Cargill and Tyson, saying, do not mess with NAFTA, Trump.
So did you say 130, Monica?
130 trade associations and food companies wrote a letter to the Trump administration saying, look, we depend on NAFTA to keep this trade flowing.
It's WBEZ's Monica Ng. She covers food and health for us, covering lots of different issues for us. Monica, thanks for that. Always great to have you on.
Same here. Take care.
If getting locked in a room with a group of friends and having to use science to figure your way out sounds like your idea of a good time, then an escape room might be just the thing for you. In Central Illinois, there's a new venue for doing just that. It's called Lab Escape. It's located in Urbana. at the Lincoln Square Mall. They had their grand opening last weekend. Our producer, Christine Herman, tagged along with a group of five students from the Society of Women Engineers at the University of Illinois and brought us back this postcard of how their day went.
It's like playing a board game, but being physically in the space and physically immersed in the puzzles and the teamwork aspect of it.
It's like the game of Clue.
Yeah.
My name is Cece, and I'm a third-year graduate student in electrical engineering. I work with these ladies like all the time, and it's always fun to get to know them better.
Being an engineer, we like problem solving, and I know that's what I really like about it, is like looking for the clues and like using your mind creatively to problem solve.
So we have some notes on like wavelengths and different physics topics, so I guess we're just reviewing them in case we need the info once we're in the escape room.
You guys think you're all ready?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it.
So as you're about to hear, we are all agents on the same team.
Agents, good to see you. There's not much time, so here's the background. Dr. Alberta Schrodenberg is a professor of physics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's a true genius. She disappeared 22 days ago. Your first task will be to find the BNC cable to connect up our newly engineered transponder.
Good luck, agents.
Thank you.
I can start looking around the rest of the room if you guys want to work on that. Oh, wait, guys, I found something.
Oh, is there anything with like lasers or lights? Because this is an index of refraction versus selective materials.
I feel like there's still gotta be stuff in that cabinet that we need.
What happens if we get logged
down?
That means you can't open it.
Permanently?
Dev, put on this lab coat.
Why me?
I don't know.
Aha!
It's for the dummy!
It's for the, oh, it is.
Camera instructions. Press on off button to turn on and off the camera.
Oh, no, there's stored images in the camera.
Whoa, that's so cool.
What codes do you have for
W, yeah, maybe X,
Y,
not Z? I don't know what the
result
would be. Nice! Yes!
Oh! Great.
I thought it was crazy how like into it we all got. Like I thought it was just gonna be like a fun little activity for, you know, 60 minutes. But we were so into it. Like we were so motivated.
That was a group of University of Illinois students exploring the new escape room in Urbana. It's called Lab Escape. Thanks to Christine Herman for producing that for us. I'm joined in studio by one of the voices you heard. It's the professor who's the brains behind it. Paul Quiot is a physics professor at the University of Illinois. And in studio with me, Paul, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So what's the premise of this? We heard a little bit about that at the beginning, but what's the premise of how this is supposed to work when you get locked into a room?
Yeah, so there's a story line that there's this missing professor, Schrodenberg, who has this lab, and there's some secret research on quantum computing going on, which could have relevance if the information fell into the wrong hands. And so the agents are trying to find out what happened to her and what happened to the other agents that went into the room and never came out again.
So what kind of prior scientific knowledge do you need to have in order to successfully solve this and get out of the room?
You don't need to have any prior knowledge at all. We do provide some information at the outset if people want to look at that, and that's usually pretty helpful. But you certainly don't need to go in with anything. You're not solving any equations. I guess I would say we need – the players do well if they have the three C's, if they have curiosity, so they're willing to explore the space and play around with things. And communication, so they can communicate their results to each other, and also collaboration, where they work together to solve problems. And one of the things we really like about that is that's exactly the same characteristics that you need to be a good scientist or a good engineer or anything like that.
And so how many people normally are on a team, and how much time do you have to solve it?
So the optimal size is 4 to 6 people. More than 6 and it gets too crowded, and also then people don't see enough of the puzzles because they're too independent, I guess I would say. And less than 4 becomes a little too challenging in that sense. And the time, we have two sort of level settings, as it were. There's a novice setting, which is 60 minutes, and then a challenge setting, which is 70 minutes. The group of girls you just heard there, they went through the challenge and they rocked it. It was really fun watching them.
So there's, I know there's this episode of The Big Bang Theory where Leonard and Sheldon and the whole gang go into escape room and they're disappointed because they solve all of it in a few minutes and they want a discount. Is there a prize or what happens if you figure it out in less than 60 minutes?
Well, if you figure it out in less than 60 minutes, that means that you've succeeded. So if you're more than 60 minutes, in some sense, you might have succeeded in some of the goals but not actually escaped.
Right.
We do keep a tally of what the shortest times are, and so the best time on our challenge round at the moment is about 50 minutes. And
those, 5-0.
5-0. And they were super, so they had 20 minutes to go, basically. And they were super commandos at doing escape rooms. So actually, they're our friends over at the Champaign-Urbana Adventures in Time and Space.
Okay.
Escape room.
And what if you don't figure it out? You obviously imagine you're not stuck in there forever.
Oh, no, you're certainly not stuck in there forever. So, you know, our purpose is to expose people to some of the different puzzles because some of them are really amazingly breathtaking to see and really cool. And so if people are kind of on the wrong track, we will try to send some hints in every now and then, even if they're not asking.
How do you do that?
Right. So there's the previous agents have been able to establish a texting terminal in the space. You heard a little bit of a deep, grovelly machine voice speaking there. And so there might be a statement that said something like, agents, can you tell us what's written on the main lab table?
Oh, so someone monitoring their – okay.
Assuming that the people are able to hook up – it also mentioned hook up this BNC cable that gives us video access to the room so we can watch everything that's happening.
Okay, so you guys can kind of keep an eye on everything that's happening.
Absolutely.
How did you pick the puzzles?
So I'm a physics professor here, and I teach some introductory physics class, and I really love demos. And so I try to use as many demos in my classes as I can. And so I had some stock of some of those already in my head. And we last spring started with a bunch of undergraduates making a whole bunch of puzzles, and some of them worked out well and others didn't work out as well. All the physical effects are fine, but you need puzzles that are robust enough that they will just keep working and for everyone. And so that can be a challenge to get things to go that way.
So when we say puzzles, what kind of puzzles? Can you give me an example of what kind of puzzle you'd have to try to solve?
Sure. So there's a puzzle that people didn't actually go through, but we certainly could have in, where there's a clipboard that seems like it's broken and it's got a bunch of tape on it, and there's a hidden message in the tape. The tape actually changes the polarization of light that goes through, and you can detect that if you have a source of polarized light. For example, like any computer monitor would work for that, although most people don't know that. And then if you have a source to analyze that, like 3D glasses or polarizing sunglasses or something like that. And if you look at this element without those, you just see plastic with no message. But when you see it with it, then amazingly this message just pops out at you.
So, Paul, what's the goal? Is it for you? Is it fun? Is it exposing people to science? Is this a money-making venture? What is it, all three?
No, it's certainly not a money-making venture. We're a non-profit organization. And in fact, if people want to help us with that on our website, you can go and you can help them with donations, which will help us bring other people who may not want to, you know, be able to pay the $20 or $15 an hour or something like that. I would say there are three goals. The most important one, well, underlying, is that everyone needs to have a good time. Otherwise, people won't come back. And I think you could hear from the audio there that people do seem to have a pretty good time. Related to science, we basically want to show people that science can be fun, and people don't always associate science and fun in the same sentence, and that it can be relevant to them and also accessible so they can understand things without being able to solve equations. So you can understand how 3D glasses work, for example, and also that it can be beautiful. And some of our puzzles and some of our artwork, I think, is really pretty breathtaking and stunning visually. And so we have those three goals, and I think we've managed to hit all of them.
So who can go to the escape room?
So it's designed for almost anyone. It's probably better ages 12 and above or 7th grade and above, but it's certainly not just for university students. And we'd really like to reach out to people who normally wouldn't consider themselves to do such a thing and maybe have an interest in science, underrepresented people. And so if there are groups like junior high teachers who want to bring the science class there, in groups, then we'd love for them to contact us and we can arrange something.
So they can reach out to Paul Quiatt, a physics professor at the University of Illinois, one of the folks behind the new escape room that just opened in Urbana. It's called Lab Escape. Thanks, Paul. And you're actually doing free 10-minute escapes this Friday at the Lab Escape Room from 4 to 7 for anyone who wants to check it out. We'll have all of the information up at our website at 21stshow.org. Paul, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
That does it for this special encore edition of The 21st. Thanks for listening. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.